Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United, everybody. We got a hot topic we're going to be talking about tonight. Can't wait to bring you these interviews. We have three interviews tonight, all with very, very talented and impressive people, and we're thrilled to do it. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry, and we're just excited to bring you tonight's show, as we are every week, twice a week.
Yeah, we just got off a good one. We had our decade-ending lists that we did on Sunday night, some really good choices all around, talking about the best films, the filmmakers of distinction, and the trends, and I thought it was a very colorful show. First of all, in between then and right now, we've had the Golden Globes. What did you watch any of it?
I watched the whole thing. I really made sure. I was really curious this year, and, you know, it's like I guess it's Avatar's race to lose now, unless I'm mistaken about that, because I didn't think it would go, you know, I think we talked about this a couple times over the years. The Golden Globe is more about, like, box office gross than anything else, so they just awarded, I guess, the highest grossing films in almost each category. But I can't say it was surprising. I did like Martin Scorsese's speech. I love Jeff Bridges' speech.
Oh, wasn't that beautiful?
That was incredible. And I love Jeff Bridges' speech, too. I was really blown away by that. I'm normally not enamored by anything at the Globes, but those stood out for me.
You know what was incredible was the montage of Scorsese clips.
Oh, yeah. I could have watched that all night.
Stunning the way it was put together. Yeah, it's always good to throw in somebody in there that really loves film, and, you know, I really liked what DiCaprio said about it. You know, if you had come first, then D.W. Griffith would be accepting the Martin Scorsese Lifetime Achievement Award.
Oh, I agree with that. There's no doubt. Speaking of loving movies, today is Fellini's birthday and Lynch's birthday.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, talk about a double dose there. I mean, a double dose of genius on the same day. That's wild.
That's ironic, too, because oftentimes with some of Lynch's films, I think Fellini. I think his love of unusual faces and things. His love of the bizarre in general.
Let me ask you this. Is Lynch have anything in the pipeline? Is he working on anything? Do we know, or is he doing the foundation stuff still, like more concentrating more on that?
Well, judging from how he talks, I picture him sitting in the middle of a room, cross-legged, meditating, waiting for ideas to come to him.
Okay.
that's my eternal image of David Lynch.
Okay.
Whatever he does next, I hope he does it. He doesn't do it on a $500 camcorder.
He might be on an iPhone.
To be honest with you, I wouldn't put it past David Lynch to make iPhone movie.
You might really do it on an iPhone or a droid or whatever the thing is. But no, I was curious, what did you, besides the Scorsese, I mean, did anything really surprise you at the Globes?
No. Mildly surprising was The Hangover winning. Because when, obviously it's a popular movie, people love it, but when I think award-winning movie, I don't think Hangover.
No, and I'm really curious to see if that will somehow end up in this 10 picture.
It could be because I've read today on Jeffrey Wells' blog, Hollywood Elsewhere. I read that a lot of the Academy voters are having a really difficult time filling out those 10 slots. They start to peter out about 4, 5, 6, you know?
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
I would think there's some... See, this is the thing, I think, the one benefit of this, and we talked about this actually when this first came up, actually, when this was decided, that it would be a benefit to the smaller film, and even maybe the studio-financed independent film, you know, like a Fox Searchlight, something that didn't, that got more theaters than you would normally see from a small film, but was not a, make a lot of money, you would think, okay, this would help a movie that's now on DVD or Blu-ray or whatever, or playing on cable. I think there I see the benefit
right.
of the 10 nominations, but I don't know.
It goes the other way, too, because you can't accuse the Academy... I mean, the Academy is accused of being rather snobbish, and so meaning they usually go for the high-end stuff,
mm-hmm.
which is usually the smaller independent film. I mean, you can't accuse them of not recognizing those.
No, you know, you're right. You're absolutely right there.
So it works the other way. I mean, it works in that the extra 10 might make room for a Hangover
mm-hmm.
or Star Trek, even though I seriously doubt that, but... They should
I was
just,
thinking more District 9 or something.
Right, right. They should just go ahead and nominate Dark Knight this year. And then,
really.
And then
I mean,
end the 10 slots.
Though, did they shoot themselves in the foot with this? Because they are going to have the equivalent or more so of the Dark Knight with Avatar. I mean, I would be really... If Avatar is not nominated... That would be the real big upset.
It's a guarantee.
No, it's a given. I'll be honest with you, Jamie. It was a given after the London premiere. When word got out after that premiere, I pretty much thought it was a given. The reviews were just glowing all around.
Yeah.
I mean, I sort of knew right there. It was like, oh, shit, we really have a serious contender here.
It is a gimme nomination. I think that and Hurt Locker are neck and neck, and I think Hurt Locker will take it at the Oscars. But I would not. It would not be in the least bit of surprise if Avatar ended up taking it.
No, it wouldn't. But I do think it's come down to those two.
Oh yeah.
I think it's really between those two, and anything.
It's really
else.
The race, and I think Avatar would win because of the weight of that accomplishment. Would factor in Avatar's favor.
Mm-hmm.
I think Hurt Locker would win. Because there isn't anyone that doesn't like it that I've seen.
Well, that, I mean, it's interesting. There are people.
Even Armand White likes it. I mean, come on.
Well, yeah, there you go.
They should put that on the poster.
Even Armand White likes the film.
That's right.
It's yeah. I mean, you're right. And the people who don't like it, it's a minority. But they're the people who liked it. I think Glenn Kenny liked it more than he ever thought he would like it. You know, the people who like it, I find very surprising.
And I know that one of our listeners, Michelle, she's really pushing for This Is It to be nominated in the as one of the top 10. Your
really?
Thoughts
okay.
on that?
All right.
I don't know. I've been telling her if you expect that movie to get a nomination, then this is not it. It's. I don't even see it getting a documentary. Is it even up for documentary? Is it even on the shortlist?
I don't know. They did the,
I don't think
the
it
foreign
is.
Film shortlist today, but I think that's the white ribbon is the given in that category. I just think that's going to be the...
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, there's another film that I really want to see, too. The French film, A Prophet, looks incredible.
Right.
And that's by the guys who did the Beat Who Skip My Heart that we talked with James Toback about, which was a remake of his film Fingers. And I saw a trailer for that last week, and it just looks incredible. I can't wait to see it.
Oh, that's what A Prophet is.
Yeah, it's a. They say what is one of the you know when they have the critics blurbs in front of the trailer, you know that everyone else has seen it except for us. But someone said as epic as The Godfather was one of the.
Yeah, I know that This Is It got a nod from the PGA, but that's a golf organization. Anyway, yeah, so it should be exciting. The ballots, I think, are due this week, next week. It's coming up soon.
When is the nomination? February 2nd or something is when the nominations are announced?
Yeah, that's when they're announced, yeah.
Okay, wow. Okay,
and they got some weird the weird tabulation system going. The you know, you have to be number one on someone's list to even be considered for the top 10 slots, or I don't know, like NASA scientists are working around the clock with big supercomputers working out this Oscar.
Wow, okay.
So it should be real fascinating what they come up with. This year, more than many others, I'll be particularly interested
mm-hmm.
in that Best
yeah,
Picture
I'll
category.
Be very curious.
Everything else I see is pretty predictable. I predicted everything except Hangover, movie-wise,
right.
on the Globes Sunday.
No, I thought, I was thinking maybe 500 Days That I Did Out or there's something. Julie and Julia, I thought was kind of another
no,
one I
no.
thought might
I,
be
I
more.
Did, yeah, I didn't predict Robert Downey Jr.
That caught me off guard. I was just like, wow. But even
I
you notice this.
I should have predicted it, though, because Sherlock Holmes clearly is one of the best musical or comedy films of the year.
Did you notice, though, in the acceptance speeches that even the winners were, like, making fun of the Hollywood Foreign Press? Like, sort of, like, toss them a,
oh, yeah.
You know, it was like, it was like this, almost like these backhanded compliments towards them. It was interesting. Especially in
yeah.
Flux case and Downey's case.
I don't think anyone quite knows what they are. They're a weird bunch. I hear
yeah,
that a lot.
Yeah, they are.
First of all, yeah. So that'll be exciting, the Oscars coming up. We all these top 10 lists of the decade have been coming up. So I finally assembled mine.
And it's a great list.
Well, I appreciate it.
No, I'm going to, if you don't mind, now, I never recovered. There's, even though I sort of blew all my money on talking about Punch Drunk Love on Chris's list on Sunday night, and I probably never recovered after that. I gave a very passionate description of why I love that movie.
That's
and
right.
That wasn't even my list. But I have to say, and I have it right in front of me, your list from this would be on the show that we cannot name on Monday nights. Number 10.
Awesome.
Bad Santa.
Right.
All right, I got to just say, I saw this the Wednesday before Thanksgiving that year, and it was the first time, with the exception of Old School that year and maybe Elf, I couldn't stop laughing. And the whole theater was just erupted in laughter, could not stop. I mean,
that's exactly why it's on the list. Because
yeah.
I looked at my list and I said, man, this is a pretty somber bunch of movies. But, you know, a great movie lifts you up no matter what the subject matter. But I thought Bad Santa, I laughed as hard until I cried in Bad Santa in the 2000s as I did with Big Lebowski
yeah.
in the 90s.
Yeah.
So it had to be on there for me. So I don't seem like a total bore.
No, you're not. Well, no. This is okay. We're gonna go through one. I'm gonna go. Let me go through each one
okay.
of these. Okay. That's just perfect. Number 9, City of God. A lot. You know, I saw this very late Friday night show in Los Angeles. And I was exhausted. And from the opening frames, you're just like wide awake. I hadn't mm-hmm. seen anything quite like it in a long time. And there's some really intense, powerful moments in it. I'll never forget any of it. It's a brilliant film.
I want Fernando Morales to make a movie like that again, to make something with that same level of energy.
Well, I think Constant Gardner has that. Blindness doesn't have that, but I think Constant Gardner shows the sparks of that. But nothing's in that league. It's hard to. It is hard to capture, I think, that energy, that momentum.
Yeah.
Like that. United 93, a film we don't hear enough about.
Right.
Very powerful. Very well. And all right, let's take the politics and the event out of it if we can. It's in very much like Munich. It's an excellent thriller. I mean, it's directed by one of the foremost action directors of his generation, Paul Greengrass.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the last 20 minutes of that film are, well, the whole film really is intense, but the last 20 minutes, especially from the passenger's perspectives, ooh.
It's great too, because politics have no part in it, as it wouldn't, because it's a real-time kind of
yeah.
movie. What I love about it was the experience of watching it, and it was really the most cathartic movie-going experience
mm-hmm.
I've had in the past decade, and not just for me, for everyone in that audience.
Yeah.
There was there was some kind of shared feeling of, you know, you're bracing yourself when it begins. You got this is it. I got to go through this. And there were cheers when they fought back on the plane.
Oh yeah.
I know some people thought it was distasteful.
Yeah, some people thought it was too soon.
Well, that, and they thought that the movie itself was distasteful.
Mm-hmm. But it was cashing in. A lot of people looked at it as cashing in.
I don't see it
that way.
It's a genuine movie in my book. So.
Number 7, AI. A very bold choice and a very misunderstood movie. It's one of those movies, like when I first saw it, I was like, it's all right. But the more you think about it, it really stays with you. There's a lot of great moments in it. There's actually one of the most disturbing scenes that Spielberg has filmed in a long time, where she abandons the kid in the woods.
Yeah.
I think is just chilling,
devastating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a beautiful movie, and it's a perfect melding of Kubrick and Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
You feel it as you watch the movie that it feels entirely of both of them in some strange way.
Yeah. Number 6. I think it's a masterpiece, Zodiac. I don't have a problem with it. I know some people aren't crazy about it, but I think it's perfect.
Alongside my number 5, this is the combo, the masterpiece combo of Obsession.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the theme, the common theme between these two.
Yeah, The Aviator, I mean, you and Chris said it best on Sunday night, so I won't go in. I mean, there's not much more I can add, but... Yeah, you're absolutely right. Just perfect. And number 4, I know you love Unfaithful. I took my mom to see that for Mother's Day because she had no interest in seeing the new guy. Couldn't sell that. Couldn't sell the new guy to her. But so we went to see Unfaithful. And that's a good. It's like really one of Diane Lane's great performances.
And Richard Gere.
Oliver Martinez.
Martinez.
Right?
Yeah. I get something out of it every time I watch it, and I watch it once a year maybe. And there are just so many directorial touches in that film that just speak volumes about character. That really make it a feast for me, feast of details.
We're still waiting. We're still wondering. You know, that do that tribute show to the director.
Adrian Lyne,
we
need to do that. He needs to keep working. I don't know. What the hell is he doing?
I have no idea. Vicky Cristina Barcelona, I mean, we did a whole show, almost a whole show about that film.
It's my number 3,
Great performances in that film. Really great performance.
One of the most emotional movies of the year for me. Of the decade.
And, he gets a really great performance out of Clarkson there, and obviously in Whatever Works, she steals the show from everyone.
It's a great movie about, and I articulated this, actually the number 3, Vicky Cristina, and my number 1, which you're about to announce, they're two great movies about regret, and I feel them just permeating from both of these movies. Yeah.
Your number 2 is very impressive, The Assassination of Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
Just a bravado performance from Sean Penn.
I'll repeat what I've said before about Assassination.
Okay.
This is our generation's Taxi Driver. I love to say that about it. And also, it humanizes and makes you sympathize with the people on the fringes, the people that you hear about, whether it's domestic terrorism, whether it's the assassination of. Pick a celebrity, John Lennon, or people like that. That, and it's a very brave movie to do that. It brings them up close to you in a way that you understand them.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't excuse their behavior, of course.
Right.
But you see this guy and you see him, a failed marriage. He can't get anywhere. He can't progress. He's a dreamer, but a bit of a dimwit.
Mm-hmm.
His country. He really has no place in his life or in society. He feels like an outsider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he builds this obsession with Richard Nixon, who shares a lot of those traits.
Yeah. You said Taxi Driver, but also doesn't he kind of remind you of the De Niro character in King of Comedy too, to an extent?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about trying to find purpose through an attachment to someone else or to an idea.
Yeah, or even the character, Lily Taylor's character in I Shot Andy Warhol, too, there's some attributes. But yeah, it's a really powerful, sadly, little scene movie.
Based on true story,
yeah.
And it's brave to come out after 9/11.
Yeah, because that's very important, actually, because if that story is where the FBI and the CIA were trained. They knew about the whole idea of flying a plane into a building. It comes from there.
Yeah.
That's actually, they were trained after this incident. This was actually, we had a very serious impact. So the whole thing, we didn't know this was going to happen. Actually, for decades, we've known about this.
And if you love Sean Penn like I do, this is one of the best best performances.
It's magnificent.
Pulverizing.
Wonderful performance. And the first one, 25th Hour, I think it's one of Spike Lee's best movies. I love that film. And Ed Norton's performance, Brian Cox, everyone. But I mean, like you said, one of the first movies to deal with the post 9/11 landscape, and it's just an incredible film.
It is, and as another film soaked with regret and so bold, so inventive in its imagery, like the best Spike Lee movies are. Visceral. And very moving. So, yeah, that's my list. I always relish the opportunity to talk about myself.
It's a really good list. So I was really impressed with it. Both your and Chris's list, I was really impressed with.
I appreciate it, man. Some good movies to talk about there. We'll be back talking about some movie news in between interviews. But I think it's high time we get to our first interview tonight.
I think so. I want to hear this. So
it's an exciting one. In Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, he dissected the groundbreaking era of 70s filmmaking and the overwhelmingly talented and colorful characters who populated it. In Down and Dirty Pictures, he took on Harvey Weinstein, Sundance, and the founders of the independent film movement. Now, acclaimed journalist and author Peter Biskind tackles his most challenging and elusive subject yet, Warren Beatty. In his new book, Star, How Warren Beatty Seduced America, Mr. Biskind examines the career of this charismatic actor with his usual sure-handed Hollywood-worthy formula, that is to say, equal parts film love and irresistible dish. This formula has created a buzz, both positive and negative, amongst the film community, as have all of his works. And for that reason, and many others, it's become the hottest filmmaker biography we've had in years, and you can actually purchase the book by clicking on the front cover icon on that homepage where you're listening to the show now. Here is Mr. Biskind discussing the origins of the book, the controversy surrounding its juiciest bits, and the intricacies of his fascinating subject. What made you choose Beatty as a subject, especially when you've covered the decade of his prominence in the 70s so thoroughly with Easy Riders?
Well, I was aware at the time that, you know, because I covered so many people, you know, not only Beatty, but, you know, Scorsese, Coppola, Bogdanovich, Friedkin, you know, Spielberg, Lucas, etc., that, you know, there was plenty of material left for each one of those people, you know, and there's been, you know, there have been a number of biographies of Coppola and Scorsese and Spielberg and Lucas. So, I felt I only skimmed the surface, even though there was a lot of material in that book. And when I looked at the, when I looked at those people and started thinking about who would I like to pull out for a full-scale biography, Beatty sort of popped out at me because, a lot of those people were, I don't mean to use this term in a derogatory, disparaging way, film geeks. Which is to say that their whole lives were devoted, at least what I mean, is their whole lives were devoted to film, and there wasn't much left. You know, in other words, they didn't participate in, you know, they didn't do much else. I mean, Scorsese, for example, lives for film.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with it. But I was sort of looking for somebody who had other interests as well to complement the film material. And Beatty, of course, had a participated in politics very fully, and he also knew everybody, you know, so that there were a lot of stories that he had to tell about other people, you know, from, you know, everybody from JFK to, you know, to Bob Dylan, and he collected people, you know, you could be riding in his car and the phone would ring and there would be John McCain asking him for advice. And then 10 minutes later, the phone would ring, and there would be Ralph Nader, you know, on all sides of the political spectrum. And then, of course, there were the women. You know, he was famous for being a Don Juan, you know, lady killer, heartbreaker, you know, whatever. So Beatty had, there were multiple facets of Beatty's life that attracted me, and I thought that would made him a particularly good candidate for a biography. And plus, at the time that I conceived this, there really weren't any decent Beatty biographies. So that was another, you know, whereas, you know, there were a number of things on Coppola, and, you know, did the world need another one?
Yeah. And in your personal meetings with him, I know you've met him several times over the years and even a couple of times in reference to the beginnings of this book. Describe him to me, because he strikes me as very enigmatic but charming, but very guarded. Is that accurate?
Well, that's accurate. I mean, that and you know, you sort of touched on the last final reason why I was interested in doing him, is because I had a relationship with him that went back 20 years, you know, and I've written about him many, many times, both for Premiere magazine and also for Vanity Fair. You know, I think you described him very well just now. I mean, he's very, very charming, but very guarded. So the first time I met him, when I was doing Dick Tracy, covering Dick Tracy for Premiere in 1989, he, you know, he couldn't have been, you know, he immediately took me out, you know, asked me to tag along while he went out for lunch with, you know, a bunch of his friends, Pat Cadell and so forth, and I was kind of a fly on the wall. He, you know, he kept me by his side. You know, I traveled, you know, when he had to drive somewhere, I went with him. He, you know, I was at his house for dinner a number of times. He even took me to a doctor's appointment with him, which was a first for me. I thought, you know, this is interesting. He doesn't have to wait in the waiting room. So, you know, yet at the same time, when I actually sat down to interview him, it was like interviewing, you know, the head of the CIA. You know, he would answer a question with a question, or he would tell me part of a story and not the punchline, or he would just refuse to answer entirely and say that this would hurt somebody's feelings, or he didn't like to talk about such and such a subject. You know, like I'd ask him about projects that he had started and didn't finish, or that were never produced, and he said, "I don't like to talk about that." You know, or you know, I don't like to interfere with my creative process. I mean, he always had a reason why he didn't want to talk about something. So, you know, it was like shooting a film with a very high shooting ratio. You had to interview him a lot to get a little.
But he was aware in recent years that you were planning a book about him, and he participated to an extent. How long did those conversations run, and when did he bow out, and for what reasons, do you think?
Well, he didn't really bow out. He never bowed out. It didn't happen altogether. I mean, it happened part ways. I first asked him to... If he ever felt it was the time to, you know, for someone to write a book about him, that I would like to do it. Back in 1989 or 1990, and characteristically, he didn't answer yes or no. And then I would go back to him periodically over every couple of years and ask him, you know, how about it? And eventually, he said he wanted to write a book of his own. And then, so I just kind of lost interest. You know, he was doing less and less movie making. You know, he had met Annette Bening, and they got married, and then he had four children. And the films he was making weren't up to, you know, shouldn't say that entirely. I mean, I thought Bulworth was a really terrific movie, but Town and Country, his last movie, wasn't very good, and Love Story was a total disaster, in my opinion. You know, he was doing less and less work, and and some of the work he was doing wasn't that interesting. So I just sort of gave up, and I was working on other books. And then he called me in about 2001 while I was working on this book on the independent film world, Down and Dirty Pictures. And he said, remember that book you wanted to write? Well, maybe it's time. So that came as a total surprise to me. And, you know, then we started discussing it. And one of the things he does, which is rather clever, is after bringing the subject up with me, then he turned around and made me sell the idea to him. He suddenly became very skeptical, you know, and said, well, you know, give me a list of 5 books where the subjects have cooperated and they're happy with the book, because it always turns out badly. And I think that David Geffen book had just come out, which Geffen didn't like and refused to, I think he started to refuse to cooperate with it in the middle after beginning, you know, initiating it.
Mm-hmm.
So I suddenly found myself a suppliant or a supplicant when in fact he had brought the idea, he had come back to me with the idea. And we negotiated for months, you know, over the phone, lunches in L.A. mostly. I didn't want to take money from my publisher unless I thought he was going to go through with it. I mean, there was no way of forcing him to. You know, he could say yes and change his mind, and, you know, I couldn't make him sign anything, and even if I did, I couldn't enforce it. So I just sort of reached a certain point, reached a comfort level that I thought he would do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and he said he had reasons to do it. You know, he said he was concerned about his legacy, and he had his kids. He wanted his kids to read something that did justice to his work, which was perfectly understandable. I mean, he's going to be 75 in another couple of years. So I thought he had a sufficient reason to do it, and so I started it. Although at one point, towards right before I was just about to start it, he told me that one reason he wanted me to do it because he thought that once it was announced that I was going to do a book on him, that there were 2 other books in the works that those authors would drop out, which I was kind of thought was crazy, and B, sort of aghast that he had, you know, in some sense just manipulated me into the interest of trying to get other people, get rid of other people. But you know, for years everybody had been telling me he was the most manipulative person in the world, so I thought, well, you know, why am I surprised? And then as we proceeded with it, you know, he participated intermittently, I would say. You know, when he was in a good mood and he felt like it, and he didn't have too many other things on his plate, he would do it. And he was in a bad mood and didn't feel like it, he wouldn't. So it was sort of sporadic.
What's interesting to me about Beatty, when I think about him, when you reflect on the great actors of the past 40 years, maybe this is an unfair assumption, but I would think most people would think De Niro, Pacino, Duvall, Hoffman. It takes a while to get to Beatty, even though his contribution in this period of film is just as immense. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that acting. Well, first of all, I think it's true. A lot of people said about him, in his prime that he was a better producer than he was an actor. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he's a good actor. You know, I think acting didn't come easily to him. I think for a long time he was a little bit like, Marlon Brando and people who thought acting was not a serious profession. You know, he initially, when he came to New York from Virginia, he wanted to write, he wanted to direct, acting was not high on his agenda, and I think he sort of fell into it almost inadvertently. I do think he's turned in some very, very good, fine performances. You know, I think Bonnie and Clyde, he's terrific in that, and he's terrific in Bugsy, which I think
amazing
is
in Bugsy.
His best role and best performance. You know, and he also had a much wider range than a lot of those people that you mentioned, not so much Dustin, because Dustin has a real comic flair, but Beatty has a real talent for comedy, which I think he displayed in Heaven Can Wait and Shampoo.
Shampoo, yeah.
You know, and I think when he started, I think he saw himself like a lot of actors did at that time in the Marlon Brando, James Dean, Montgomery Clift mold. And I think in later years, I think he felt he had more affinity to somebody like Cary Grant. But if it was, he was only an actor, I think his reputation wouldn't be, he wouldn't deserve, you know, the attention that, you know, of a major biography. But I think, you know, that he did produce, he did direct, and he did write, and he excelled in all those fields. And I think, you know, and he also did a lot of other things. So I think Beatty is somebody for whom the whole is bigger than some of the parts.
Well, he was a hyphenate, as you said, and he wasn't as prolific as these other gentlemen. And also what surprised me about your portrayal of him in the book is that he never considered himself a character actor like those other guys. He knew his value as a movie star.
Right.
And he kind of tailored his image along that vein.
Yes, very much so. I mean, he was very, very self-conscious and analytical about his image and how to present it in the best possible way. You know, he would tell, you know, the biggest cinematographers of that generation how to light him.
Mm.
And where to put the camera, you know, and it was, you know, people were sort of amazed by that. You know, he used Storaro and Conrad Hall and William Fraker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what's his name?
Vilmos?
Yes, but also I was thinking of Willis, you know. Gordon Willis, who did The Godfather, was probably the great, well, maybe he and Storaro, the greatest cinematographers of that generation, and he had no hesitation about telling them where to put the camera, where to move it, or when not to move it.
Beatty as a collaborator, then. Usually at odds with any director that he worked with. My favorite Beatty is McCabe. And that was not a harmonious relationship he had with Altman on that. He always had to be in control in some sense.
Yes, I mean, I think that's true. And, you know, I think, you know, God knows, you know, his need to be in control probably comes from some sort of, you know, deep-seated, some deep-seated seed in his youth, you know, with his family. But I think when he started out, you know, he was very much in the thrall of the auteur theory, like everybody was in that generation. So he, you know, he worked, his first film was directed by Kazan, and then he went on to work with leading playwrights, William Inge and Tennessee Williams, and some of the leading directors like Robert Rawson and John Frankenheimer, and he and Arthur Penn, and he put himself willingly into their hands, and I think that he discovered that every time he did that, things went wrong, and if he didn't control every aspect of the film, it was going to be a disaster. And I think that's one of the things that propelled him into the, you know, wanting to produce, wanting to direct.
Yeah,
he was a lot smarter than a lot of the people he worked with or for. I mean, he's a very, very smart guy. I've, you know, rarely met anyone as intelligent as he is.
Well, you would think his prowess as a director himself, that he would why he would choose to work with other directors if he didn't respect their role as director of these films.
Well, you know, I think he, you know, directing, doing everything yourself is really time consuming and exhausting. You know, directing is a very physically exhausting activity, and I think, you know, in a lot of ways it was just easier for him to act and have somebody else direct. And the problem, of course, was always, if he was, you know, could he give up, could he cede control to somebody else? And he did and he didn't. And then the question is, who do you get? If you get a really strong director like Scorsese, who he approached, you know, major directors for a lot of his films, and a lot of them just didn't want to work with him because they knew his reputation for controlling the movies, and they wanted to control the movie. So Scorsese told me that they quarreled over Final Cut of Dick Tracy, who was going to have it, and Scorsese ended up dropping out.
Mm-hmm.
But then on the contrary, if you get a director who is malleable, or you think is malleable, like Glenn Gordon Caron for Love Affair, that can be a disaster as well, or, you know, or what's-his-face who directed Town and Country, Peter Chalson.
Mm-hmm.
That can be a big problem as well, because if you're de facto controlling the movie and yet you don't have that authority officially, Beatty knew that it was bad for his reputation to be seen as, you know, covertly controlling the movie. So he was in a bad position, especially in a film like Town and Country.
Yeah, the elephant in the room when you think about Warren Beatty are his romantic exploits, and I know your book has gotten a lot of press for this aspect. What was the value in investigating this like you did? What does it express about him in a larger sense?
Well, I mean, I think his, he was a victim. You know, he nurtured this image himself. First of all, it was true. I mean, there's a lot of truth in it. He did, was very active, romantically speaking. But he also nurtured that image because it kept him in the gossip columns. And this was, long before he was a big star.
Mm.
So it helped him. But I think, became so infamous for it that, he got himself into a lot of hot water with Leslie Caron because she left her husband and she had two children, and it sort of turned against him, that he was seen as somebody who broke up families and broke
right.
up marriages. And then his reputation for being a Don Juan overshadowed his reputation as a filmmaker. So I think you have to, in order to understand the sort of problematic or the problems that or paradoxes that bedeviled him in the course of his career, you have to understand the cost, how much that cost him, that aspect of his life. And at the same time, he used a lot of his girlfriends in his movies. He used
yeah.
Julie Christie a couple of times. He used Diane Keaton. He used Annette Bening. He made movies with, and he used Leslie Caron. He made movies with these people he was going out with, to some degree, for example, and that affected the movie. So to some degree, Reds reflects the plot of Reds, and the performances in Reds reflect his relationship with Diane Keaton. I think it would have been a different movie, possibly with a different actress.
Mm-hmm.
He initially wanted Julie Christie for the role. So that's, you can't really understand Beatty, I think, without understanding that aspect of his life.
Does he long to make another great film, one last great film?
I think he does. I think for somebody as who has as much pride as he does, and who saw himself as somebody who might run for president, plausibly might run for president or governor of California, or senator from California. In other words, a player, a big player, not only in the movie business and world, but on the world, on the political stage. For him to go out with a film as lightweight and as Town and Country is humiliating. And I think he's competitive. He's always been a very competitive person. He's competitive with people like Clint Eastwood, who gracefully made a transition from leading man to director and is in some ways antithetical to Beatty.
Works
quickly, makes decisions quickly, and he's made a lot of very good films since he stopped being a leading man. And I think Beatty would like to go out on a big movie, and he should.
Yeah, and that movie might, as you write in your book, it could be Howard Hughes. Would that
be? It could
be
Howard, yes, it could be Howard Hughes.
Another great enigmatic figure.
A lot of the people who, there have been many, many Howard Hughes scripts, and, I did interview Bo Goldman, who essentially wrote Dick Tracy and wrote
mm-hmm.
a Howard Hughes script for him, and Goldman talks a lot about the things that Beatty and Howard Hughes have in common, and so it's a natural subject for him, and a great subject for him. I think he could do a great job with it.
I think so, too, yeah. Before I let you go, the independent film movement, which you wrote about so eloquently in Down and Dirty Pictures, how has it changed since you wrote that book? I a lot of the studios bought up their own specialty labels, and those have gone belly up or shut their doors altogether in recent years. Where do you see the landscape of indie film now?
Well, as you point out, it collapsed, after you know, after that book closed. I mean, in other words, you know, I published that book in 2003 and was writing up to the very last minute, and I think the seeds that, I mean, the things that happened subsequently, you could see that the seeds were already planted. You know, the heyday of independent film studios started the indie divisions, and then there were so many of them, and so much money was going into indie films that I think that, you know, there was a sort of gridlock in the marketplace, plus the films that were made by the indie divisions, as the budgets kept going up, became more and more like studio films. And so the idiosyncrasy of independent films eventually disappeared. And then people, you know, in my view, you know, the audience started staying away. There were too many films, and they weren't good enough. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there are other explanations for it. And, you know, then came the financial crunch, and everybody's cutting back. And, you know, a studio can't make as much, even an indie film that does well, with the budgets going up and attendance plateauing off, you can't do as well on an indie film or a pseudo-indie film, an Indiewood film, so-called, as you can on some of these big blockbusters. And, you know, but on the other hand, I do think that with all the technological changes and changes in distribution and the Internet and the fact that you can make a film for a dollar and a half now is all to the good.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, there are a lot of people coming up, talented people coming up, and, you know, this stuff is always cyclical, and we'll see another resurgence of independent film before too long.
Do you think this has been, this past year in movies, do you think it was a good year?
No, I think it was a bad year. I mean, there were some good films made this year, but not very many. I mean, you know, I liked, you know, I think, like everybody else, I guess, I loved Hurt Locker, and, you know, I thought Up in the Air was pretty good. But, you know, I didn't like much else, and I haven't seen Avatar. Can't quite bring myself, having had it with large green men, large blue men, with the Watchmen,
right?
Which I was very disappointed in. So, you know, I'm going to see it, but I haven't rushed out to see it. But aside from that, you know, I think it's the good films this year, few and far between.
Yeah, it's what timing to expand your Best Picture to 10. It's interesting to see how they'll fill those 10.
Yes, exactly. Well, I think, you know, there are films like Crazy Heart, which is pretty good, not great, but, you know, respectable. You know, there are a lot of films like that that I think, you know, it's funny that I do a film, run a film festival up in where I live in upstate New York, and every year, you know, when I start, it's like 10 years old, and when I started the American Independent Films, the presence was very strong, and now for the last 4 or 5 years, the foreign films are way better than the American films. There's just no comparison, and I think that tells you something.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your time so much. This is a fascinating, engrossing, delicious read, like all of your works are. And let's do this again sometime. Come back and talk movies with us.
Absolutely. I'm flattered that you asked or are interested in, and I appreciate it.
All righty. Peter Biskind, the book is Star, How Warren Beatty Seduced America. It's on sale now. Get it, read it, love it.
All right, sounds good. That was very fascinating. That was a good interview. That was very good.
Yeah, he's an interesting writer.
Yeah, he is.
You think the Howard Hughes project is promising for a big major swan song from Beatty?
It is, but I don't see. It will be interesting to see his take on it. But we already have like really one masterful film.
This would be the latter half of.
Yeah, it'll be the latter half. So I mean, it'll be very interesting to see how he does it. I'd just love to see. I mean, he does need to do something. I really think he. I mean, don't think you want Town in the Country to be the swan song. I mean, I'm serious. That was a very.
Yeah, that's his welcome to Mooseport, really.
I hope not. I mean, I'm sure something else, but I do think, and I do remember there was talk. That, I mean, for I think it was in 2000 or even a little bit before that. That there was serious talk of him running for president.
Yeah.
There was very serious talk, and I wouldn't rule out this governor of California. I mean, there is talk still. You hear it. Whispers of him wanting to run for governor.
He's a smart guy. He's a smart guy that knows everyone on both sides of the aisles,
yeah,
politically speaking. And I think he's too smart to do it.
Maybe, but there is something.
I don't think he likes the system, and I don't think he believes it can be changed.
I think you're right there, but I don't think we've heard the last of him. I think there's something else that he wants to do.
Well, this Hughes thing has transfixed him since 73 or in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And he was asked about it 11 years ago on Charlie Rose, like 1998, and this is what he had to say about it.
Will the Howard Hughes film ever be made?
Yes.
By you?
Yes.
It will. When?
That's...
You go too far. I'll make it. It's important to make for what reason?
The Howard Hughes movie?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like one of those things, you know, like one of those pregnancies.
Like John Reed or like...
Well, it's one of those pregnancies. And you try to hold back those labor pains as long as you can. And then...
Because
you want to do other things. You want to spend time doing other things. And you want to know more.
Know more?
Yeah, about what you're doing.
Thanks again. Pleasure to have you on this program.
Great.
Pretty cryptic.
Yeah, that was very cryptic, actually.
He'd probably say the same thing today if he was asked.
I'm sure he would.
I think it would be a great... look, he's a man of enormous talent, and he's a man that is underappreciated or overlooked in some circles because he lacks the extensive resume.
Well, remember, he was supposed to play Bill.
Right.
And he said, I think finally had enough of Tarantino saying, well, this is how David Carradine was doing. He's like, well, why'd you get David Carradine to do the dance movie then?
Yeah. It was too much of a time commitment.
Yeah.
He was also concerned about the level of violence.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been interesting to see Tarantino working with Beatty.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see any director who comes with their own baggage and their own heft.
Yeah.
Take on Warren Beatty, because it's a strong creative force, Warren Beatty.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, it is.
Yeah. So, have you seen any movies in the past few days before we get to our next interview?
I only, since our show, I didn't, because we had a lot of crazy stuff this weekend, so I didn't get to see The Lovely Bones, so hopefully this weekend I'll get to see that. I did see The Book of Eli.
Oh.
On Friday afternoon, and I thought that was just incredible. I really liked it.
You did?
I did like it. And I mean, we can talk about it more later. I did like. It was not, I mean, it was kind of what I expected, but then there's just some nice surprises in it and some nice touches from previous, post-apocalyptic films, also samurai films and westerns. There's so much cool stuff in it. I was really impressed with it. But you know what I watched the other day, because I've been meaning to watch it again for years? I watched Death Proof again on DVD.
Yeah.
I just watched that for the hell of it. I hadn't seen it, and I like that movie a lot. It's a lot of fun. That's the only thing I've seen since our last show, though. I just haven't gotten around to anything else.
It is fun.
It is.
I haven't watched anything, so don't feel like you're a slacker. Okay. I've watched 24. That's what I watched.
How is that this season? How?
It's good. It's the damnedest thing. Because every season, the beginnings of every season, they're always faced with, you're really stretching credibility here. A guy gets pulled back for the 9th time, and he's got 24 hours to do the thing. And damn it, if it does it when it works, you just forget about the parts that aren't so credible. You know?
Yeah. Well,
you're sucked back in just as he is.
Cool.
I do think they need to kill him this season. I do because their whole concern has been with making the show feel like anything is possible to keep it fresh. I think they need to kill him. I think that they need to recast with another actor. They need to look for a bankable name to bring to TV, someone with gravitas and that you want to see in action. And I didn't think that was Kiefer Sutherland when the show started.
No, I don't think anyone. It's the best thing that happened to Kiefer Sutherland.
It's a perfect fit. It really is.
But you think it's time to get rid of him?
Yes.
Okay, so who do you want? Do you want the guy, Richard Dean Anderson from MacGyver to come take over? Or do you want MacGruber? You
right.
want MacGruber to come?
I was thinking more along the lines of Lori Petty. I mean, somebody really tough that you could...
Oh, God, Tank Girl, yes. Yes,
I'm kidding about that.
Oh, I love Lori Petty. Tank Girl.
I don't know. I got no idea. That's worth thinking about.
No, it is. No, I'm curious. I'm curious to see who they would get, if they did that, who they would get to take his place. Chloe. They just give the series to Chloe.
Right. And this season has Freddie Prinze Jr. In it, and it's still believable.
Oh, man. Well, there goes Freddie Prinze on our show.
Yeah, he's fine. Extraordinary Measures, are you going to head out and watch that this weekend?
I'll try. I mean, I'm curious about it. I won't lie to you. I'm curious. Harrison Ford, you know. I even saw Crossing Over. I mean, so...
Let me say something about Crossing Over, and I'm in the minority about this. I thought there's a great movie in there. I can sense it. I can see it, and obviously he had so many problems with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a shame because I do think a great movie is hibernating in there.
No, there is. I agree with you there. And I like the director Wayne Kramer, who did Running Scared and the Cooler. So I mean, there's no doubt that the guy knows how to handle things, but. Like, just, it felt, for me at least, it felt too much like Crash.
Well,
That's just the way I looked at it when I saw it. But I haven't seen it, like, for a year, but that's just what I remember.
And that's a negative for any movie.
True.
It had that stench to it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But I was involved in the subplots that were there. And I was real interested in seeing what that Sean Penn subplot was.
Mm-hmm.
Because it felt like it was missing an arm, you know?
Right.
And it had to have been this Sean Penn subplot. Which is unprecedented. Unprecedented. That I would imagine it is. That an actor would film a movie and then say, I'm not happy with it. Cut my part completely out.
Right.
And they do it. And they do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does he owe them something now, I would think?
I don't know. What was the deal? I don't know. What was his problem with his part? What did he ever say?
To my understanding, he thought it took a different direction than he had initially agreed to.
Mm-hmm.
He found it offensive, maybe? I might be wrong about that. But how's that for getting paid to do a movie and convincing them to cut you out of it?
Yeah, really? Wow.
Well, he did the work, I guess.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
No one will ever see the work.
True.
Yeah, so that's a shame. I thought Harrison Ford was fine in it. It was like his The Border.
Mm-hmm. That's,
which
that's
is a good, good film.
Way to look at it, yeah.
That's a good film, The Border.
Mm-hmm. Very good, very underappreciated film.
Yeah,
forgotten film.
That?
Wasn't that Tony Richardson?
Okay.
I'm going. I'll look it up, but I'm pretty sure it's Tony Richardson.
I think you're right. Yeah, yeah. It's like that movie always reminds me of a Springsteen song because, well, you know, there's many Springsteen songs that remind me of The Border. Okay.
Yeah, Tony Richardson. Yeah, and Wallen Green, who wrote The Wild Bunch, wrote it too with David Freeman. Okay.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a pedigree right there.
Yeah, I mean. Yeah, I remember that that film when it came out was a big deal.
Yeah, I caught it on cable a couple of years ago, and I thought, hey, this is a solid film.
Yeah, it is.
Extraordinary Measures opens up this weekend, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
It's an important movie for Harrison Ford. He's executive producer on it as well. He kind of nurtured it from the beginnings of the project. And it's a drama about parents of two children that have a rare genetic disorder, and they track down a scientist in hopes of speeding up a possible treatment. And they have to jump an enormous amount of hurdles to make that happen. And it looks like a feel-good movie.
Mm-hmm. It looks like like a Lorenzo's Oil for this century, I guess you could say. That's what it reminds me of, at least in the trailers.
Right, right. I guess the big sell here, or the big hurdle that they have to jump here, is selling a movie about sick children. That's always
hard. Well, the first one. I mean, you know, they do have a hurdle here because they have the movie last year, My Sister's Keeper, which, you know, had an A-list cast and everything, but just couldn't escape the that made for TV, you know, feeling that it had.
Yeah.
And you had A-list people on both sides of the camera, and it just couldn't escape that. So I'm just curious to see if they'll be able to
do
that.
Well, that's it.
Here.
That's it. How do you sell it?
I don't know how you do this.
And the same story with Lorenzo's Oil, which is has some extraordinarily powerful moments in it. But that's not the burden to bear for our guest that we speak to tonight, the screenwriter of Extraordinary Measures, very accomplished gentleman. Oscar-nominated, Jerry. We have an Oscar nominee on the show tonight.
Awesome.
Yes. His name is Robert Nelson Jacobs, and other works include some work with Lassie Hallström.
Oh,
actually,
cool.
one of those projects was nominated for an Oscar, and that's Chocolat that he wrote.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I like that movie.
You like Chocolat?
I do.
It's actually one of my girlfriend's favorite movies.
What's not to like? Lena Olin and Julia Binoche in the same movie. Like I said, what's not to like?
Right.
You know?
Also, The Shipping News. He wrote the screenplay for that for Hallström.
Oh, okay. That's right. He did that one, too.
Yeah, The Water Horse and Dinosaur. I think his first one was Out to Sea, the Jack Lemmon Walter
Matthau.
Oh, yeah,
that's right. All right.
This is a guy that really crosses genres. He's very diverse.
The Water Horse is a very underappreciated film. It's actually a very charming film.
Yeah, yeah. We had the director on, and he just did that one after Ladder 49. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember talking about that.
Yeah.
Here is Robert Nelson Jacobs talking about his work on Extraordinary Measures.
Doesn't it have its own...
What do you talk? I'm busy. You're always busy.
You always want to talk. Yeah, we could add fear and then try and cleave it before purification. What are you doing?
Giving you a preview.
Guys, would you excuse
of
us
what's going to happen
yeah.
if we are not in clinical trials in 4 months. Our investors will turn out the lights.
Science takes time, Jersey. Don't they understand?
Yeah, they do. They can read the Wall Street Journal. They see that Zymogen is testing 3 different Pompe drugs.
They're testing 3 because they don't know what the hell they're doing. I'm testing 1 because it's the right one.
I know. I believe you, Bob.
Look. I want you
to go toe-to-toe with Zymogen scientists. That's the reason I've entered into conversations with them to buy our company.
You're telling me? You're not asking me?
Oh, come on, Bob. I am just being fiscally responsible.
Nobody's gonna tell me how to run my lab.
If I can engineer a deal, and that is a really big if, you're going to have to forgive me for all the money I'm gonna make you.
I don't care about money. I'm a scientist. I care about more important things than that.
You tell me about more important things to care about.
First thing I'd like to know is, are your beginnings, when you were initially taken by film and when you thought you would like to write for film?
Well, I think I wanted to be a writer from pretty early on. I remember like in sixth grade, I used to wake up early in the morning and get a yellow pad and go down to the kitchen table and write these really bad science fiction stories. You know, and I still like the quiet of the early morning hours to do my work. You know, but I think that was kind of when the bug hit to tell stories, to write down stories. And then, after college, I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I was writing short fiction, where they publish, you know, if you get your stories published in these nice little literary magazines, they pay you by giving you copies of the magazine so that you can show your parents that you're actually doing something with your time.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always kind of loved movies, and always kind of had this idea in the back of my mind to come out to California and give it a try. And so after graduate school, I loaded up my little car, like the Beverly Hillbillies, and came out here and proceeded to starve for a number of years. Worked with a partner for a while and had a few little development deals, no movies that got made. And then at some point I got an idea for an original screenplay, a sort of romantic drama with a little fantasy twist. And became really obsessed and started getting up really early. I mean, I would sort of wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and couldn't wait to write. And worked on the story and wrote the script very quickly and then did a number of drafts. And that was really the script that that opened all the doors for me. Before that, it had sort of been, you know, little deals that didn't lead anywhere. And this one, the movie never got made, but I sold the script, and it kind of got me the jobs to write the first three movies that got produced, you know, Out to Sea and Dinosaur and Chocolat. I mean, movies that, you know, all couldn't be more different from each other. You know, different genres, different tones, you know, and that one spec script that I wrote kind of opened all those doors. And I think it really has to do with writing something you're passionate about. I just became obsessed with this idea and had to write it, you know, because it was sort of bursting in my head. And you know, I think because it came from that deep sense of urgency, you know, I sort of discovered a voice. I discovered a voice as a screenwriter and got me noticed. And as I say, it got me the first three movies that were produced. It was all based on people reading that spec script and deciding to hire me.
Hmm. I'm looking over your credits.
Yeah.
And you alluded to it just now. There's an incredible diversity in these different projects. Is that something that is important to you to maintain?
Yeah, I'm not sure it was ever a conscious choice. It's just something. It's just an inclination that I like to. I like to work in different genres and different tones. I've worked on a couple of animated films, dramas, comedies. It's just more fun. I like to mix it up.
Yeah. To talk a little bit about, excuse me, these first few credits, Lassie Hallström, you've worked with several times.
Yeah.
And these are both, like Extraordinary Measures, they are adapted from books, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
What are the specific challenges to that?
Well, one difference is that, those were both adapted from novels. Extraordinary Measures is adapted from a nonfiction book, which carries sort of a different standard of responsibility with it. I think whenever you do an adaptation, you have to kind of at some point make it your own. You absorb the book, you figure out what you love about it and what kind of moves you about it, and then you kind of put it away and retell the story in cinematic terms. And sometimes that requires some fairly big changes. You have to sometimes not use things that you loved in the book. You have to invent other things in order to compress and tell a story in under 2 hours that otherwise, if you were being completely, quote-unquote, faithful to the source material, you'd have a 15-hour movie.
Right.
So that was certainly true of Chocolat and of Shipping News, where I had to make, you know, big changes and take liberties in order to make it cinematic and to bring the vision of the director, Lasse Hallström, to the screen. He's got a wonderful kind of a cinematic sense. Then when you're talking about Extraordinary Measures, this was a story, you know, based on real events, inspired by real events. There are certain things that you have to honor in terms of the medical facts of the story. I had to talk to a lot of scientists and make sure that I could get the science as right as I could. You know, but at the same time, take great liberties with character and event. I mean, some of the things that happen to the kids in the story happened when they were much younger than they're portrayed in the movie. But I couldn't make the movie take place over, you know, 5 or 10 years. We really needed it to be a more compressed time frame than that. So I took events that had happened earlier and kind of, you know, put them together with events that happened later. The other thing I had to do was compress characters. I mean, the character of Dr. Stonehill, Harrison Ford's character, there are several scientists whom Dr. Stonehill represents at different points in John's struggle to find a drug that would save his kids' lives.
Right.
So you take certain liberties so that you can tell the story cinematically and efficiently, you know, and it was very helpful to have Harrison involved as an executive producer even before I started writing to talk about his character and the structure of the story and just kind of how we were going to tell this story in an economical way. And then, you know, Tom Vaughan came aboard as director, and he was also very helpful in making sure we could make this story work in cinematic terms.
Well, this was Harrison Ford's his baby.
Mm-hmm.
He shepherded
yeah.
this project from the beginning.
Yeah.
When he conversed with you, what did he say he wanted from it? What did he want it to be?
It wasn't so much saying what he wanted to do. I mean, it was really a discussion, it was really a lot of talking about discovering what the structure of the story was, like sort of what point in time we want to start the story.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we always knew that we wanted to show. You know, we had all been moved by the true story of the Crowley family, and one of the things that moved us was how the sort of grace and the humor with which this family dealt with huge challenges, and we wanted to get that sort of strength and that humor into the film. You know, so right from the beginning, we're saying, you know, let's find, you know, some of the fun and the joy of this family, you know, and set that against the sort of very difficult, urgent struggles that they were going to go up against. And you know, Harrison was helpful with that. I mean, the other thing about Harrison is, you know, I'd get into discussions with him. We'd start talking about specific scenes, and I would say, well, maybe it starts this way and it goes like that. And then, you know, I remember at one point he started yelling at me, and it was really scary. And then I realized that he was yelling at me in the voice of Dr. Stonehill, that he was actually playing the character in the scene. You know, but when Harrison Ford is yelling at you and calling you a son of a bitch, that can be a little upsetting until you realize that he's playing the character. And then I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. He's getting into the scene. That's great.
Yeah, and Harrison's character has a journey of his own.
Mm-hmm.
Was that obvious from the outset? Is this based on a real life counterpart? And was that that person's
well,
journey as well?
Sort of yes and no. I mean, you know, some of this was borrowed from things that we heard about real people, but some of it was just a discussion about what was going to work well as a film character, particularly you know, when juxtaposed against John Crowley, who's this very kind of, you know, positive guy with good people skills, you know, a businessman, a realist, a guy who doesn't give up, and you know, so we said, okay, the scientist has to lack some of those qualities. He's got the scientific brilliance that John doesn't have, that John needs, you know, but he doesn't. But Stonehill doesn't have those people skills, and you know, and doesn't have what John brings to the table.
Yeah.
You know, so that these two guys, it creates conflict between these two guys. But it also, you know, it's one of those cases where they need each other, but they're kind of coming from different places. So a lot of his character was designed to play against John and create some sparks, and again create some humor. That it's almost there's a bit of an odd couple dynamic between them.
Yeah, that contrast
is
crucial, I would think.
Yeah, yeah.
And how do you relay the science cinematically?
You know, one of the decisions we made, I mean, it's interesting. There were a lot of discussions about how to convey the science, and do we sort of want to come up with cute metaphors? I remember writing versions of it where there were sort of cute metaphors. You know, this is Mr. Enzyme, and he's got to get into the cell, and then at some point we really felt like Dr. Stonehill has to sound like a real scientist, and we're really going to use a lot of the real terminology, and it's going to be pretty clear. I mean, the audience is going to understand basically what's going on. Even if they don't understand every word he's saying, they're going to understand kind of what the challenge is and the way in which Dr. Stonehill is a trailblazer. You know, and you know, we wanted to give him some credibility as a scientist. You know, and most of all, that he's passionate about. When he's talking about science, you can feel his passion. So we felt like, you know, we didn't want to dumb down the science and use cute metaphors. We actually wanted him to explain it in some. There's a couple of scenes where he explains in some detail what he's trying to accomplish.
Tell me about your collaboration with the director, not only on this project, but the other projects you've done. How crucial is that relationship for you?
Well, it's really important, you know, and it's different in every movie. You know, sometimes I've worked very closely with the director. Other times, you know, it wasn't that close a collaboration, and there were other writers involved, and it really depends, you know, project to project. You know, I was very fortunate on this project that Tom Vaughan and I worked very closely together, and when the movie was in production and he wanted to make changes or the actors were asking for changes, he always let me know. We talked about it. You know, sometimes I would rewrite pages shortly before they were going to be filmed. You know, people sometimes ask, gee, does it bother you when, you know, we get this phone call that the actors want to change the lines? It's like, well, no, that doesn't bother. What bothers me if they change the line and they don't call me.
Right.
I'm very happy to be consulted. You know, a scene can always be made better. You know, nothing's written in stone. You know, it's when they change it and they don't tell you about it that it's that's more problematic. If they're calling and saying the scene doesn't work, you know, you got to do some more work for us, I'm always happy to do that extra work.
Right.
Happy to be involved in that discussion.
I would think in the other cases when you're not able to be so involved in rewrites,
mm-hmm.
you do have to have a thick skin.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, and there are different projects have different characters to them. I mean, not fictional characters. You know, each project has its own character, has its own quality. You know, and sometimes you know that you've just been brought in to write a draft, or you know you're just there to fulfill a certain function. You know, you're going to help them with structure, and then they're going to bring in somebody else to whatever, write jokes. I don't know. You know, and then there are other times where you really feel like you're an organic part of the process from beginning to end. And you know, this was one of those.
Yeah. When you craft the screenplay for Extraordinary Measures, obviously you've structured the story, the events of the story. Do you have in mind from the beginning what the movie actually is about, what the theme of the film is, or does that come to you during the process?
No, I think you have to know pretty early on what it is you're trying to say. You know, that we knew, I mean, in this case, it was very clear because we knew about the sort of emotional journey of the Crowley family. We knew that our story had to capture that spirit. This family, you know, who were told by all these perfectly professional, well-meaning doctors that there is no treatment for this disease, for Pompe disease. You know, and that it's a terminal disease, that you're going to lose your children, and that the Crowleys just refuse to accept that. I mean, it's really a story about not giving up, and we always knew that. You know, so that we knew that they had to, that we had to start with a family who was in this dire predicament, that there were going to be times where they were close to giving up or where it seemed like they had lost, but they were going to have to keep getting back on the horse, you know, until they crossed the finish line. So it was very clear sort of what the structure of the story had to be. And then within that, we knew that the Dr. Stonehill story, the Harrison Ford story, was about a guy who was kind of disconnected from people, who had brilliant ideas, but that he wasn't ever going to be able to bring those ideas to a useful place unless he had help from someone. I mean, there's a moment in the script where Brendan Fraser says to Harrison, you've got all these great ideas, you're curing all these great diseases in theory, and they're never going to help a single person in reality, you know, mm-hmm. unless you're willing to make certain accommodations, unless you're willing to be businesslike about this. You know, so that we knew that was kind of Harrison's arc, is that he had to go from being a theoretician to somebody who could accept practical constraints in order to get the job done.
Right. Have you seen has there been a premiere or a screening that you've attended?
There's going to be a premiere this week, and I'm going to go to that with my family, and I'm looking forward to it.
So when you've written the screenplay for these films that you've done,
mm-hmm.
and you see the finished product, are you able to separate the writer from the experience and lose yourself in it?
Yes and no. I mean, you never really lose yourself in it. I mean, even when I see someone else's movie, it's very rare that I lose myself in it. I'm usually there's that writerly part of the brain that's working and going, that's interesting. I wonder if they had done this instead, how that would have worked. You know, in the same way, if you know, at least when I watch a mystery story, I'm always trying to figure out, okay, who did it and how have they covered their tracks. You know, every story has those. You're looking for the tricks and how they work and how it's going to pay off. You know, when you watch something that you've written, I guess for me, you're remembering a lot of decisions that you made. You're remembering, okay, yeah, that scene used to be like this, and we made the decision to create more suspense in the scene by, you know, by delaying this character's entry into the scene, whatever it is. I mean, lots of technical decisions that were made, structural decisions that were made. You're remembering all of those decisions. I mean, even years later when I see a movie, I'll look at it and I'll remember conversations that we had and decisions that we made, you know, about structure of scenes and even specific lines of dialogue.
Right.
So you're kind of doing both. I mean, to answer your question, it's kind of a, you're doing both at the same time. Hopefully you're enjoying the movie, but you're also kind of remembering. And then there's always, I mean, inevitably there's something I see where I said, you know what, I think we should try it this way. I mean, you're still kind of working on it even though it's too late and the movie's in the can. I mean, every movie I've done, I've had that experience where I'll look at it and go, you know, I think we should try the scene this way. And then, of course, you remember, oh, the movie's already finished.
But when you watch movies and you notice...
Yeah.
You're critical of the writing, and you notice maybe a place where the screenplay stumbles. Generally, where do bad screenplays stumble?
Well, there are lots of ways. You know, there are many more ways to do it wrong than there are to do it right. You know, one reason that scenes don't work. In fact, more often than not, when scenes don't work, it's because they haven't been properly structured. It's because the characters aren't entering the scene with the right motivation, or they're not entering the scene at the right place and time, or the writer hasn't given the actors enough to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, you know, if dialogue seems weak, a lot of times it's because the scene or the structure hasn't been properly conceived. And so the dialogue is a symptom of a deeper problem. I mean, that's
right.
Assuming that the writer knows how to write dialogue and knows how people sound when they talk. You know, but even somebody who's good at dialogue, if a screenplay or a specific section of a screenplay isn't structured well, the dialogue will suffer as a result.
With dialogue, and I'm not a screenwriter, so this is completely just an observation from a movie
mm-hmm.
fan.
Mm-hmm.
When I notice that dialogue is not authentic,
yeah.
it's usually because it feels too on the nose.
Yeah, it's on the nose, or it's, you know, it's giving you exposition. It's giving you information that the
mm-hmm.
writer needs you to know, and it hasn't been conveyed in a dramatic way. You know, when it's done well, it's kind of seamless. I mean, you know, often the best way to get dialogue in is through conflict, is through people having an argument, or, you know, people having opposing goals, and then they're, you know, each giving their point of view, which is conveying information to you, and they're motivated to say it because they're pissed off at the other person, or they're trying to win a debate, or whatever it is, they're pursuing a goal. I mean, it's always about what is motivating the character, and there are times where people say things to each other. You know, it's like in a commercial, it's like, gee, I've noticed that this bank has a lower interest rate. Really? Is that right? Tell me more about it. Where there's no reason, you know, these people are not motivated to say what they're saying in the way that they're saying it, but somebody has to get information in about this bank, and they've only got 30 seconds to do it. You know, but that happens in screenplays lots. I mean, you know, that's always a pitfall and always something you have to watch out for, that there, you know, there's information that you know you have to get in, and how can you figure out a way to make it seem motivated and natural and believable that people will say this.
When you're present at, say, the first table reading,
mm-hmm. yep.
That has to be a crucial part of the process for you to hear these
yep.
these words out loud.
Uh-huh. And there's always stuff that doesn't work as well as you thought it would, and everybody knows it. You can feel it. You can hear it. And you have to go back and work on it again. And then there's also, you know, this wonderful thing that happens when you add actors to a script, which is that they bring readings to it that you didn't expect, and you go, oh, yeah, that line is actually funnier than I thought, or that line is sadder than I thought, or whatever. I mean, that they bring a sort of subtext to it that you weren't entirely aware of yourself.
Yeah.
And that's great when that happens.
I always like to ask this question. Do you have three or four examples of perfect screenplays where you can look to and say, this is how it should be done?
Oh, gee. I mean, you know, if I look back at my favorite movies, I mean, you know, Chinatown is one that a lot of writers love.
Oh, yeah.
You know, where everything fits together and it's all so dramatic and so wonderfully dark. And, you know, there's a sort of tonal consistency to it. It's really funny. It's really dark. I've always loved, you know, one of my favorite movies growing up was The Last Picture Show. They don't make a lot of movies like that anymore, where it's all about character, where it's just, you know, completely character-driven, and there are these wonderful you know, every actor in that movie gets to do wonderful work and has moments where the everything's just coming to a stop and the actor gets to play out a certain emotion. And you know, a lot of times monologues don't work very well in movie, but that movie has, like, you know, several wonderful monologues that are totally great and completely believable. And
right.
You know, there's a kind of patience that the movie has. I'm sure I'll think of 10 more as soon as we start talking, but those are the ones that come to mind.
Does writing for the stage interest you at all?
Actually, when I was in college, I was writing plays. I wrote and produced and even acted in some things. You know, maybe, I guess, I actually think about, you know, someday writing short stories again, going back to fiction writing. You know, fortunately, for the last however many years, I've been fairly steadily employed as a screenwriter. So, you know, that I'm fortunate enough to you know, have employment, so I keep going with it.
Oh yeah, and your career is amazing. These are amazing titles that
you've been
behind. Before I let you go, it's the season of Oscar, and I wanted to know what your Oscar experience was like. This was 2000.
For Chocolat, yeah. You know, it was great. You know, it happens. It's so intense that it's kind of, it rushes by and then it's gone before you know it. There's a kind of an unreality to it, but it was very exciting. You know, I mean, look, you know, it's great. I was very grateful for the experience. But, you know, when you come down to it, the thing that I enjoy most is actually doing the work. I mean, it's fun to go to a party and see movie stars and occasionally talk to them. It's even more fun to be in a room with a really good director or really good actors and be working on the script and talking about it and making discoveries. That creative experience is still the part that's both the most difficult and the most fun. I mean, it's the main reason to do it.
Yeah. And what's next for you? Do you have something lined up?
Got a couple of things going on. Again, very different projects. I've got one project, an animation project that I'm about to start working on, and then I've got a kind of a sci-fi thriller, a very small, modestly budgeted sci-fi thriller with a little bit of dark humor in it that I've almost got set up maybe to get filmed later this year, where it's a script that I wrote on spec, I mean, an original that I wrote just because I wanted to, and I would be one of the producers, and it was just something I wrote for fun. Mostly because it was very different from anything else I had ever done, and just wanted to challenge myself in that way. And so that may go into production later this year.
Okay, Extraordinary Measures opens up this weekend. Harrison Ford, Brendan Fraser, check it out.
And Carrie Russell, right? Isn't she in?
Yeah, Carrie Russell.
Okay.
Can't forget that.
No, I remember her from the ad. So, I mean, she was also an August Rush in Waitress. And
that's right.
She's had a decent, like, movie career since Felicity, so.
Well, Waitress is a great,
yeah,
great movie.
Awesome movie. And I think, wasn't she one of the daughters in The Upside of Anger?
Yes, she was.
Okay, all right.
And let's not forget Mission Impossible 3.
That's right, okay. No, you're absolutely right. I like Mission Impossible. All right, never mind.
Do you really?
I do. It's not. I mean, it's not great. I mean, but it's much better. You know, I enjoyed watching it. I can't say it. The Mission Impossible films for me have always been, like, somewhat, like, lackluster, but I didn't mind that one for some reason. I don't know.
Who would you choose as director of a fourth one?
Oh God, I really want to see Fincher because he was attached to it at one time. So I'd really like to see David Fincher do it, or Paul Greengrass is another one I'd like to see.
Well, that would be something, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's get to our last guest. And unless there was something you wanted to discuss before we get to it.
No, I think we covered a lot. So, and we got the big Sundance show on Sunday, right?
We got Sundance, Slam Dance. We're combining the two. We got some Slam Dance in there too.
Oh, cool!
So we're going to do both dances on Sunday.
Awesome!
And we're going to talk to several guests that have films represented at both festivals. So you'll get an insider scoop on what to expect, and that starts tomorrow morning, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's yeah. I mean, you got that, and they've been making the announcements of the Berlin Film Festival too. So they there's some films I think that are in Sundance that are going to be in Berlin, too, so.
It's always interesting. I mean, we're going to be flooded with news reports and of what movies are being buzzed about and that people are crazy about at the festival, the festivals, and that really sets the groundwork for the remainder of the year.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, a lot of these you always hear about. There's a lot of discoveries. So it's always a fascinating time for me to keep up on the festival discoveries.
No, it's wonderful. Like, I go to IndieWire or The Wrap and, you know, keep up with everything. And then all the other, like, all the blog sites and everything. It is. It's very exciting.
Yeah. All right, our next guest is John Frizzell. He is a great composer, a composer with a terrific amount of credits. And he's another one that can do any genre. Stuff like... This was one of his first ones, Beavis and Butthead Do America.
Oh, cool. All right.
And then he did Alien Resurrection. I mean, so those are completely different ends of the spectrum there.
Yeah, I would say.
He's also done movies like The Reaping and Henry Poole Is Here and Whiteout. His new film that he composes for is Legion, which opens up in theaters this weekend. Will you be checking that out?
I'm actually kind of more interested in that than I am Extraordinary Measures, but that's just me.
Yeah.
But it does look kind of – it's very interesting that we have these – in the span of a week, we have these two religious-themed films, The Book of Eli and this other region. So it's a curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
So
– what does that say to you?
You know, in the darkness, we're trying to find God. I don't know. made that up. I think we're, in all seriousness, maybe we are. I do notice this trend of, and you could also make the argument that some of the lines that Mel Gibson utters in the Edge of Darkness trailer have religious undertones and overtones in them, quite surprisingly. But it's just really interesting that two movies in the span of a week are coming out. But this one looks like a very violent version of The Prophecy. Remember those movies with Chris Walken?
Chris Walken, yeah.
Yeah,
I do remember.
I'd be curious.
Okay, so let's get to John Frizzell as he discusses Legion and his love of technology and how it streamlined the composition process. And he also mentioned some great soundtrack scores that he loves, that he considers his favorites. It's an interesting discussion. Here is John.
I was interested in film scoring, but I never really thought of it professionally because I became really obsessed with jazz in college, and I was sort of a bebop snob, and if it wasn't Charlie Parker, it wasn't real music. And I was just very in that really wonderful world of really studying jazz in depth, but in a very kind of closed way. And then after school, I went to work for Mike Maneri, who's a great jazz vibraphonist. But Mike has a very open sensibility about music, and there was a lot going on at the studio. And I ran a synclavier there, which was one of the early digital music workstations. And from that, I got exposed to all sorts of sessions. I was working on hip-hop records. I was working on commercials. I was working on short films. And one day, a buddy of mine named Gil Goldstein, who's an extraordinary musician, arranger, and pianist, asked me if I wanted to work with Ryuichi Sakamoto as a synthesist on a miniseries called Wild Palms that Oliver Stone produced. And it was just a great opportunity, and I had a fantastic time working with Ryuichi, who had just won the Academy Award for The Last Emperor. And I was just completely taken by the experience and knew that that's what I would be doing.
What was it about the process that particularly excited you?
It was just watching a scene transform and come to life with score. And I had never really examined score that closely. I had never really seen it work. And to work with such a legend as Ryuichi was just an incredible way to start. And I never really thought of my music that way.
Right.
It was kind of funny because at the time I was doing a lot of, I made my living primarily doing commercials, and people would ask me to score commercials and have them sort of sound like a film. So I was, on one hand, sort of going down that path and didn't realize it. And it just took sort of life to whack me over the head and say, hey, listen up, this is what you should be doing, for me to get on the right track.
But it does take a special gift for interpreting material, interpreting characters, to give
to give those things musical voice. Is that something that you found that you had the ability to do right off the bat, or is it something that's kind of sharpened in you over the years?
I hope it's sharpened. I hope I get sharper, not duller. That would be bad. But as I say, I'm composing now. Someday I'll be decomposing, right? I studied literature for a year, and I have a great love of stories, and I love a lot of the Russian writers, and I did some stage stuff. I was always pretty terrible in front of an audience, but I liked the idea of acting. I just didn't like actually doing it. And so perhaps maybe there's a part of me that likes to act with music. I think as I've hopefully grown as a film composer, I'm very, very into story now. I probably used to be more into making scenes, and now I'm very fixated on being part of storytelling and what storytelling really means and how you shape a story for the human mind and how human minds are drawn to stories and why we need stories in all cultures.
Well, with the advent of computer technology and synthesizer technology, and I know you're very adept at that.
I'm actually at the NAMM show right now, and at the Anaheim Convention Center, bugging all the software developers.
Tell me about how that streamlines the process, how it helps you creatively, that technology.
Well, There's flexibility. I use Logic Pro as sort of my home base for writing music. And the technology has just gotten to a place now where you can think about something, and if you have the right equipment and the right things, I can create sounds that are somewhere in between being acoustic and electronic. In fact, people are sort of asking me this question a lot. So is this score acoustic or electronic? And the answer to that is yes, it is acoustic or electronic. And kind of bugs, you know, the answer doesn't really answer the question, but this line between these two worlds has gotten very gray. And I'm taking a lot of acoustic things and taking them slightly out of context to confuse and put the ear of the listener in a place where they can't quite identify what things are. And I really enjoy doing that. And I think it lends itself to storytelling, and the film's going very well. Yesterday there's a new version of Logic, which is true 64-bit. And I'm now able to use such vast amounts of RAM that it's going to really change my process. And these advances in computers aren't making the music, it's making it more organic. See, it's gone the other way now. The computers first came in and everything got more electronic sounding, and now there's this incredible flexibility to make things really organic.
Well, we were talking to Marvin Hamlisch the other day, and we were discussing. He was talking about the direction of the film scoring business now. And
by the way, his score to The Informant just knocked me out.
Brilliant! Oh, it's such
God,
a unique
I
score.
Love
it. Oh. But he was expressing that it seems more and more there's a trend of using score almost to double as sound effects in a way, and he's missing the themes. Is that something you find that you're most attracted to, the themes?
I really try to keep those two things in check. You know, I think I've never heard it firsthand from Ennio Morricone, but I've read that the score to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is a lot about the sounds of the desert, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of my favorite scores ever written. And I know that if you listen to Jerry Goldsmith's score to Planet of the Apes, you're also crossing this line back in this, what is that, 69 of, I think it's 69 or 68, I can't remember. But you're crossing a line of music which is right on the cusp of being an ambient sound.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really enjoy doing that, but I try to balance it with thematic material, and I hope that's what people get from a score like Legion, where I'm really crossing both areas. So I try to keep that in check. I don't want to just write a bunch of ambient things that just go on like that, but I do that sometimes.
Well, you've scored several all the genres of film, and I mean, you're very versatile. And I'm curious about those genres and the specific challenges of each. I hear that the most challenging of all is the comedy for a composer.
It is. Hardest score I've ever written was Office Space.
Mm.
And it's one of the shortest scores I've ever written, too.
And what makes it difficult?
I think that... Okay, this is just a theory. Go ahead and someone call in, tell me I'm wrong, but... The comedy originates as a in your head. It's more of a brain thing rather than a heart thing, right? Is it comedy is usually some sort of paradoxical situation which refers directly to our society or our culture. It's not like a core thing, like an emotion, like love. And so you kind of have to figure it out in your head and then craft the music to help and somehow accentuate. Or be there in support of the joke. I don't think it often works to have the music be the joke.
Right.
You know, Office Space was so challenging because I'd look at every scene in the film and it was really funny without music. But when I'd watch the whole film, it needed music. And so where to put it was really tricky without stepping on a joke or hurting it. It was a very sort of clinical and intellectual process to figure out where it goes.
Did you use screenings? Yeah. Did you use test screenings as your guide for that?
Oh, the test screenings on Office Space. I mean, Office Space was such a wild experience because when it came out, no one liked it, and now it's, you know, it's Office Space, and so that that was a tough time, but it was really my judge and myself just figuring out, you know, this dilemma of where things went. Beavis and Butthead, when I scored that film.
Mm-hmm.
It was easier because, in a sense, there's a lot of parody going on. In fact, when I started that film, I had a long conversation with the great Elmer Bernstein about his philosophies behind scoring comedy relating to Airplane and you know, some of the other great ones he did, Stripes and things.
When you're working in a particular genre, when you do mini projects in a similar genre. Do you worry about falling back on the same kinds of sounds? I mean, when you think horror genre, you think a particular kind of music. Do you set out to work against the stereotypical music?
Yeah, I mean, I do put a lot of effort into that. There are sort of structural ideas where I'll think, well, this reminds me of a scene I did in such thing where maybe there was a tempo or some sort of structural concept which will relate. But I try to design a palette of sounds for each film which makes it stand out and be unique. And I also, you know, I'm a pretty big geek in terms of computers, and I'm usually got some new thing I want to try because there's some new software out that I want to experiment with and work it into the score in some way. And that was the case with Legion. There was a bunch of things I made. I sort of built a whole library to score the film.
Tell me about that library and how those ideas came about to put the music to Legion.
Well, one of the things in Legion that I kind of like is I took some very short recordings, say like a cello. It was maybe a 2 or 3 second piece of audio, and I stretched it with a piece of software to be maybe 30 or 40 seconds long, right?
Mm.
And then I put that across the keyboard, and it becomes this pad. And you can't really tell. It sounds like a synth pad, but it also has this, because it was once a really organic sound, it has the physical shape of a human touch to it.
Right.
And I just sort of came up with this term that I call them frozen sounds because it's kind of like stopping time. And there's a lot of those in that score. And they were really fun to work with, and I made a whole bunch of them. You're like a cook, and you find some new combination of things, and you start experimenting with it, and it takes you to someplace new. And I love doing that.
terms of scoring, I mean, I can imagine what score should do for a film. It should accentuate the emotional journey of the characters and different moments. But what shouldn't a score do?
No, that's a great question. What shouldn't a score do? You know, I used to think that a score shouldn't strive to put the viewer in an exact place, right? But I've come to believe that that's really wrong. I've come to believe that filmmaking really is about deciding where you need your viewer to be psychologically, and if you want to call that manipulating, then that's perhaps a fair word. But where do you want the viewer to be? What emotional state do you want them in so that this story will be entertaining?
Mm-hmm.
Or moving or life-changing if you want to go to a higher level, you know. And so what a score shouldn't do, I guess when a score is trying too hard, that's usually when it's probably failed the most.
Right.
You know? But I think often these days there might be an overcorrection for that where it tries too little and you do get some pretty banal things going on. No names will be named, but things that just feel like, recycled.
Right.
Some people call it tempitis, where it's just the composer's just gotten a temp and just had to do something and being pushed to do something that's very similar to it, and it just kind of gets stuck in a cycle. It's something that can happen, and I don't know that there's any more bad scores today than there were a long time ago. I'm really not one of these people that thinks, you know, everything's going bad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, I always say this, is if you think about how many operas were written in the 19th century and how many we remember, probably 1% was any good at all, and the rest are in the trash. So we really tend to remember the good stuff, and that's why the past seems so much better. And so I think that those are probably the two errors that you can make in scoring. Overdoing and underdoing.
Well, now we think a special challenge to scoring would be in determining where not to put music, because I think part of what you're talking about is in terms of having too much score in a film, you need to let the movie breathe in a way.
It just depends on the film. I mean, some films just want to just soak it up. They just need score everywhere, and that's right for them. Castaway? Remember, mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember the score. I don't think the score comes in for something like an hour into the film.
Mm.
And when it comes in, it just knocks you out. I think it's when he's out on the raft going out over those big waves or something, somewhere, or the whale. I can't remember exactly where it is, but I just remember it was an amazingly long time. And you're almost as thirsty for music as he is for civilization.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a really clever use of waiting for music.
In the history of film music, I always love asking composers this question, but do you have three or four essential scores that you always like to go back to?
Yeah, I mean, it does evolve a little bit, but I just don't get away from The Mission. I always want to listen to The Mission. And I always want to listen to Papillon.
Mm-hmm.
And I always want to listen to Close Encounters. And what else? Those are some of my big favorites. One of my favorite all-time scores too is Iron Giant. Michael.
That's
Caine.
True. Yes. Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Love
those
that.
Are great.
Those are
great scores. Yeah.
Oh, great.
And the soundtrack for Legion. What does that mean for you? Because you're composing a score in the service of a movie when the actual CD release of your soundtrack. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think that a really good film score can survive both. It's a good listen, and it primarily serves the picture, but it also translates to a good listen. For those people that are interested, and some of them are film score fans who just really love film score. Some people are maybe particularly just into the film and want to get that vibe going again, you know?
Yeah.
So I really, you know, La La Land Records has done a great job with making, I think, a CD and a booklet that has cool stuff that people who like the film will really enjoy. So
yeah.
It's fun, and it's a really nice way to preserve the history of film music and let people further into the process and really get to hear the music in its own pristine environment.
And before I let you go, I need to ask you about some of the upcoming projects that you've got. You've got a film called Shelter coming up?
Yeah, not sure of the release date. It's a really dark and creepy one, Julianne Moore. And I love that film a lot, so I'm hoping you're going to see it in theaters soon. I don't know the release. And then there's The Roommate coming up, which is Leighton Meester, and a dark thriller. Really good film.
Wow. Well, when Shelter comes around, and I think it's probably in a few months or sometime this year at least. I think so. Will you come back and talk to us?
Would love to. Yeah, and
right.
Great question. Thank you. Sometimes I feel like I'm the one who gets to learn from these talks. So it's always like a therapy session where I get to look at myself and a bunch of people listen to it.
All right, that's John Frizzell. The movie is Legion. It opens Friday, and the soundtrack started to be on sale on Tuesday,
mm-hmm.
and you can purchase it here on the homepage, of course.
Yes, of course.
All right, it's been a packed two-hour show.
Yes, it has.
We'll be back with another packed show for Sundance on Sunday night, and then
cool.
We'll announce our future shows very soon.
Awesome.
Jerry, thank you, man.
No, thank you. And, no, it's a good show tonight. And thanks to everyone for tuning in.
I'll talk to you Sunday.
All right, cool. Take care.
All right.
Bye.
Thank you.